This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the recently deceased great social activist Marilyn Clement, who was a good friend and comrade of Reverend Lucius Walker's. Reverend Walker will join us today to reminisce about his 40-year friendship and work relationship with Marilyn Clement.
We'll talk with an attorney from the Center for Constitutional Rights about the recent favorable ruling in the case of the Fraternal Order of Black Firefighters.
Wait until you hear this. In a city that's 27% black, 3% of the New York City Fire Department is black, and our mayor, Bloomberg, is defending its practices. But a federal court is finally opening the fire department to minorities, blacks, and Hispanics.
We'll also look into the Republican organized mobs who've been disrupting town hall meetings on health care.
Stay with us.
As many listeners may know, Marilyn Clement, a great social activist and founder of Healthcare Now, died on August 3rd. Early in her social activism career, Marilyn Clement joined the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and worked with Martin Luther King in Atlanta. She moved to New York City after King's assassination, where she was the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and before that, the associate director of the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organizing. She founded the New York-based advocacy organization Healthcare Now in 2004. We're joined by a longtime friend of Marilyn's, Reverend Lucius Walker, the founder of Pastors for Peace and the executive director of the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization. Reverend Walker, welcome to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
It's a pleasure to have you here. We've worked in the same vineyards over the years lately on stuff around Cuba. But I know that like me, you were a friend of Marilyn Clement.
Yes.
Marilyn passed on August 3rd, and I know she worked with you most recently at Healthcare Now, which was an organization that she founded in support of the single-payer notion for healthcare. And I wanted to ask you if you could tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you met Marilyn and your relationship with Marilyn. Let's talk about her.
Sure. It's a pleasure to talk about someone who is so rare and wonderful as Marilyn. First met her maybe in 1967, late 67. I had been for 10 years prior to that living and working, community organizing, and developed a community center in Milwaukee. IFCO was being incorporated by a very progressive group here in the city, and I was invited to set the organization up. Happened to meet Marilyn, who had come to the city because her husband's job resulted in the family moving from Atlanta to New York. She joined the IFCO staff in those early years. I met her in the interview process and felt that she was a remarkable person. Just a little about her background, perhaps.
That would be very interesting to our listeners. And they may know or they may not know that IFCO is the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organizing,
organization
which you head. But tell us about Marilyn in those early days in the 60s.
She came directly to IFCO from a position on the staff of Dr. Martin Luther King in Atlanta, where her family lived. She had helped draft and was directing a special project to do outreach to black ministers, black pastors. So she came with good credentials, having worked for King, having been close to some of the planning of projects to, spread, his philosophy of resistance to racism through nonviolence and through direct action. She therefore fit perfectly into the IFCO mode of work, which was very much fashioned after the example of Dr. King. The thing that struck me about Marilyn, going back to her, even her childhood, she grew up in the panhandle of Texas. She, I think it was Amarillo.
Atulia, Texas, I think.
I think she was born in Atulia. It's a little town of Atulia in the panhandle, not too far from Amarillo. Now, obviously, if one knows anything about the history of that region and race and racism, that was a hotbed of area was a hotbed of racism. Race and racism and Jim Crow were supreme. Yet, as a young child, she was clear enough and her analysis was profound enough that she rejected the racist ideology that was around her.
What was so remarkable to me also, Reverend Walker, that here's a person that grows up in that sort of place, the daughter of sharecroppers in the panhandle of Texas. She got herself a college education, and she got politicized and radicalized in the 50s when that was very rare. A person like myself in the 60s is one thing. Marilyn was a radical from the 50s when it was quite difficult to make those connections.
This was a conviction that she arrived at kind of herself. I mean, she sought out the influences that made that analysis possible, and she was both among her family members and her friends in that area. She was a beacon of light. She was an example to the contrary of the prevailing race ideology of the area where she grew up.
She wanted to be a missionary and then ended up working with Dr. King. But take us past that. Now, she comes to New York, and what kind of work was she doing with you at IFCO?
She was, first of all, she became very quickly associate director of IFCO and helped to supervise a staff of field directors, program directors who were evaluating projects throughout the country from southern rural areas, from urban areas, north, south, east, west, Appalachia, Native American organizing and self-identity efforts. So she was in the thick of some of the most dynamic and progressive movements among people of color and poor whites in the country. That was the reality of IFCO, and she was helping to direct and guide that and to do proposal writing and fundraising and technical assistance to many such groups. So in the IFCO context, she found a natural place to naturally use her skills and her interests.
She did so also when she moved on. She became the head of the Center for Constitutional Rights, its executive director. That's when I met her in the 70s and 80s, and I remember her good work against the Ku Klux Klan and also organizing against domestic spying, which was kind of a natural outgrowth of doing civil rights movement because the FBI had their agents inside of our organizations.
Both of those pieces of work, the FBI and COINTELPRO and dealing with all that, were things that she really started doing at IFCO. It was very interesting. She really was key staff, along with myself, in dealing with a COINTELPRO operation that sought to break IFCO's back. In 1969, IFCO convened the Black Economic Development Conference, out of which came the call for reparations. 6 months to the day, we were visited by the IRS, and they wanted to examine 1.5 years of IFCO's financial records. Well, it took them, and this is, it's not only about Marilyn, but it's about the context in which we were all living, those of us in the movement in those years. It took them 3 years to examine 18 months of our financial records, which meant they were in the office every day. They were trying to tie up staff, having us photograph, mimeograph documents that they needed. It was pure harassment and an effort to break our back. She was key to helping us move through that whole process. So when she went to CCR, she knew firsthand just how COINTELPRO was operating, what it meant to have the agents of various branches of government knock on the door and in their arrogance try to use techniques and methods to break the back of an organization. She was drawn to the work of CCR partly because it was an effective legal arm for combating so many of the forms of oppression and the efforts to break the backs of our work, which she had experienced at IFCO.
For those of us who've just tuned in, we're speaking with Reverend Lucius Walker, who is the head of the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization. He was a friend and comrades of the late Marilyn Clement. Marilyn passed on August 3rd at age 74, and we're just reminiscing about her work and Lucius's memories of her good work. And we're going to take it up to the latest phase in her life when she founded Healthcare Now here in New York City to advocate for a single-payer healthcare system. Lucius, tell us about that phase of her organizational life.
Well, very interesting, Michael. That phase of her life began at least as early as 1970. In 1970, while she was still on the staff at IFCO, she had this passionate desire to work on single-payer health care. And she was the first person I ever heard articulate the concept of single-payer health care. The work that she did later in founding Healthcare Now was a culmination of a dream, really a passion that was hers from early on. It partly grew out of the reality of living in the Panhandle area, having family and neighbors and friends that were simply victimized by the system that denied health care to them, in which people could live without health care, and the human atrocities that she had seen. And it moved her, as she was always moved, to look at a problem and find a solution. So her seeing the reality of people living and suffering without adequate health care drove her naturally, being the organizer that she was and the visionary and the prophet that she was, it drove her to the single health payer concept. But when she founded Healthcare Now, of course, we joined with her, as we had been with her in the seeing this passion develop in her. But it was not something that came new late in life. She had harbored that dream, as I said, as early as 1970.
She was extraordinarily visionary in doing that. What was so amazing to me was that she started this organization, and it grew and it grew and it grew. And you were part of that, too. Talk to us about how Healthcare Now spread out across the country and the bill that it proposed.
Well, basically, it not only in Marilyn's head and in her heart, but also in her apartment. that was the quote office, unquote. She rallied her friends around. The meetings, the organizing meetings were held in this wonderful apartment that she had downtown. She had done a lot of congressional outreach in the early years at IFCO, so doing outreach to Congress was not anything new, and she built on that to do outreach in Congress, which ultimately resulted in a very strong relationship between her and John Conyers, and John, being a champion of health care, conceptualized the concept in H.R. 976. She was key in helping to influence the drafting and the movement of that, and drawing around her people from all walks of life who shared her vision for a single-payer health care system in the U.S. But it started, as I said, in her heart, in her head, and in her apartment.
Wonderful. It's an idea whose time has come.
Sure.
It's not going to go away.
And I don't think without the energy, the passion, the vision, the drive that Marilyn brought to it, I simply can't imagine that we would be as far along as she is now. I'll tell you another more personal story about how dear to her heart was that movement, that work. She left in her instructions for her family that because this was such a crucial moment for 676 and for the achievement of health care as a reality, that she did not want a funeral or a memorial right now, but to get beyond that battle and maybe later in the year or early next year do a memorial for her, because she didn't want to do anything that would sap energy from the movement, which was the passion of her life now, at such a crucial moment. Just a wonderful, amazing person.
He sure was. There's going to be a memorial for her at Judson Church at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on October 17th, several months in advance. For you listeners who want to come to it, you could write that down. October 17th, Judson Church, 1 o'clock. But there was, while she was with us, a night commemorating her back in June at Judson Church. And I just wanted to, in closing, read what she said about her life work. Lucius, what's your reaction to Marilyn saying, "Being an organizer is an honorable profession. For me, spending my life as an organizer for change in this world has been a fantastic way to spend a life."
That's Marilyn.
Yeah. Reverend Lucius Walker, thank you very much for all your good work and for being with us today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You take it easy.
Right on.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Last month, a U.S. federal judge ruled in favor of the Fraternal Order of Black Firefighters in that New York City has been discriminating against minorities in firefighting hirings. The case, similar to other firefighter cases, brought to light the disparities in the results of hiring 5,300 firefighters from 1999 to 2007. Out of the 3,100 black applicants and 4,200 Hispanic applicants who took the exam, only 184 black firefighters and 461 Hispanic firefighters were ultimately appointed. These practices helped make New York City the least diverse fire department of any major city in America. The Center for Constitutional Rights attorney Darius Charney says, "This is a tremendous victory that we've been fighting towards for over 7 years, and we applaud the court for recognizing that the Fire Department of New York's written examination has no bearing on whether or not a firefighter is qualified." Darius Charney joins us today. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
So the Center for Constitutional Rights had a recent victory in your firefighters case.
Yes, we did. And actually, I should mention, we had another victory. You know, we had made a motion many months ago to try to get the deposition of Mayor Bloomberg in this case because he was very personally involved in a lot of the decisions about the tests.
Yeah, we're talking New York City here.
Yes,
it's a major firefighter's decision against racism in New York City.
So our motion to compel his deposition was granted today, this morning, by the same judge who issued the decision last week.
Congratulations, Darius. That's great.
Excited about that.
Let's start with a sort of overall picture of the statistics. What is the racial composition of the fire department in New York City?
Well, right now it's, you know, somewhere in the area of 3% African American.
And what's the percentage in the city?
27% of the population is black.
And what about Latino?
Latino, it's about 7% of the fire department, and again, about, you know, 27% of the city.
So any major city worse than New York?
Absolutely not.
How do they accomplish this great feat of racism?
How do they accomplish it? Well, I'd say that a decades-long, you know, effort on their part, for lack of a better word, of using discriminatory exams, doing a really terrible job of recruitment, and just creating a very unfriendly environment for people of color in the fire department.
Can you elaborate on those three strategic prongs in their strategy?
Well, the test is probably the most important one because that's the one we have focused on. And for a lot of civil service jobs, not just in New York, you know, there's a civil service test that is given to people who are interested. And, you know, for many years, probably up until the 1970s, you know, most civil service jobs in the country were tested for using paper and pencil exams. But starting in the 1970s, I think a lot of, you know, industrial psychologists and also people in the federal government who were interested in, you know, equal employment issues started looking at, you know, alternative ways to test, especially for jobs like firefighter, which is, you know, obviously a very much of a physical job. Beginning in the 70s and the 80s, a lot of cities' fire departments were switching to these more innovative ways of testing, you know, using things like structured oral interviews, what's called situational judgment exercises, to really try to replicate the kinds of decision-making abilities that a firefighter would need to have to be able to succeed on the job. So it's actually a more accurate way of testing for the qualities that a firefighter needs. And it also, those methods have shown much less of a discriminatory impact on racial minorities. New York, of course, has been totally opposed and unwilling now for decades to consider using any of those kinds of tests, and has continued to use a paper and pencil, multiple choice, essentially reading comprehension test, which is more akin to like the SAT or one of those, you know, high school standardized tests that we a lot of us had to take when we were in high school. You know, that really tests reading comprehension. That's really the main thing it tests, you know, ability to read a paragraph and then answer questions about it.
How do they explain not using the more modern test?
Well, I mean, Bloomberg, of course, has said he doesn't think the test is discriminatory.
If there's a practical component that arguably would make for judging better fire personnel, I would think, and if the rest of the country has shifted to that, it would seem that as a progressive city that we think we are, we would be doing that.
I mean, one of the things they've been saying is, you know, we're New York City, we're the biggest fire department in the country. We, you know, give the test to 20,000 people every time that the test is held. There's just no way we could feasibly do things like structured interviews or situational judgment exercises. But that's really a bogus argument for a couple of reasons. One is that a lot of other large fire departments in the country, you know, Chicago, for example, Los Angeles, they are able to use exams that have some of these kind of, you know, more practical methodologies. And no one would argue that they're small by any means. You know, Chicago, the last test that they gave, I think over 20,000 applicants took it, and there's an oral interview component for that. So, you know, that argument about size is just completely bogus. You know, and the other thing is in New York, I mean, you look at like some of the other city government jobs, you know, they're using some of these methods. You know, the sanitation department, for example, the police department. I mean, those are huge city agencies that have tests that they're given to a lot of people. So if those agencies can do it, those other cities can do it, it seems New York can do it too.
How long did this case take to litigate? What's been the result so far? What are your expectations? But really, what happened at court?
Well, the case really started in 2002 because we filed a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is the federal agency that oversees Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And you have to do that before you can go to court. So they investigated actually for over 2 years, and then they made a finding, which is very rare for them to do. They made a probable cause finding that the city had, in fact, discriminated. Usually what happens when you file an EEOC complaint is they just say, we looked into it, we don't see any problems, but here's a letter, you can go to sue in court. In this case, they actually made a finding, and they asked the city to participate in a negotiation to come up with, you know, a resolution voluntarily. The city refused to do that, so then they referred the case to the Department of Justice.
Now, this finding was made by the EEOC. It was made under the Bush administration.
Exactly. Any claim that this is, you know, some kind of politically motivated Democratic, you know, campaign against non-Democratic mayor is completely untrue.
My mouth, I got to tell you, Darius, my mouth drops at this case every time I hear you go over it or anyone, that the city with the what's the percentage of blacks in the department?
Around three, between three and a half.
In a city that's 27% black. We have this expression, which I'm sure you know as a lawyer, res ipsa loquitur, the thing speaks for itself. What else is there to say? I mean, it should be over. And the fact that they wouldn't negotiate initially and that Bloomberg is defending this lawsuit?
And Michael, same with Latinos, 7% on the fire department.
Just every time I hear you talk about it, it's like I'm flabbergasted.
So, you picked up on it. You know, so the Bush Justice Department got the case referred to it in, I think it was 2006. They then also tried to engage the city in negotiations, which the city refused to participate in. The DOJ then in the spring of 2007 actually filed a federal lawsuit in Brooklyn, in federal court in Brooklyn. The Vulcan Society, as the original, you know, plaintiffs in the case, were permitted to intervene as co-plaintiffs.
Explain who the Vulcan Society is.
The Vulcan Society is the fraternal order of black firefighters here in New York City. It's actually one of several chapters of Vulcan societies around the country. You know, we're all black firefighter organizations around the country. I mean, they've been around for, you know, upwards of 40 or 50 years and have been working on this issue for much longer than CCR even has. You know, they've been working on this. They brought a lawsuit in the 70s against the fire department for this very same problem. So this is, you know, a long-standing problem. And they've just been fantastic, you know, advocates for change in the fire department, you know, not just through the litigation, but through outreach and organizing efforts and, you know, lobbying the mayor and the city council and all those folks with, you know, on their own with a very limited budget, they've been doing this. So they're fantastic champions for this cause here.
What happened next after the Bush intervened in 2007?
So the lawsuit, yeah, the lawsuit was filed in court in 2007. We, you know, went through discovery for about a year and a half, and that ended in the fall of 2008. Filed this motion for summary judgment this past spring, which, I mean, you guys probably know this, in civil rights cases, for the plaintiffs to do that is a very rare thing because usually the other way around. The defendants are trying to move to get the case thrown out.
Summary judgment means there's no issues of fact and you should just win on the law.
Exactly.
And that's usually not done by the plaintiffs. That's right.
Exactly. And so we, you know, felt very strongly that the facts were so overwhelmingly in our favor. I mean, that there really were no disputed facts. You know, the stats speak for themselves. And then in terms of the second issue that this case involves with, not just that there's a discriminatory impact, but then that the test is not actually valid. That we also felt there was really no dispute because, you know, the city's own testing experts, you know, offered, I think it was about a 3-page defense as to why they said the test was valid, whereas, you know, we were submitting hundreds of pages of analysis of, you know, the test questions and the test development and all this stuff. They threw in 3 pages. And the judge, you know, agreed with us. He ruled that the test was definitely not valid, and of course it was discriminatory, and therefore the city had violated Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And now we're at the point where we have to talk about, so what's the remedy? How do we fix the test, and how do we compensate, you know, the victims of discrimination, all the thousands of Black and Latino applicants who've never hired?
Is one of the possibilities that those candidates from the past might be allowed to retake the test? But when will a new test be implemented?
Well, currently the fire department, I think they actually have a hiring freeze, but most recently they were hiring off of a list that was developed using a test they gave in 2007. We tried to challenge that test as well in our lawsuit because we feel it's pretty much the same problem, but the judge didn't want us to address that test. So that test is still being used. However, you know, one of the things that we need to figure out is there obviously has to be compensatory hiring for some of the victims of the prior two tests. And, you know, there would have to be a process set up where they could show that they are at least presently today still capable of meeting all the, you know, requirements for the job. That process we haven't even begun to figure out yet, but there would have to be some kind of, you know, compensation for the victims of discrimination. And, you know, the courts have been very clear that when you're talking about compensating victims of past discrimination, you can use race-conscious hiring for that limited purpose, you know, to compensate the actual victims. So we'd have to identify who they are, you know, the folks who took the test, who are still interested in being firefighters, because some of these guys took this test 10 years ago. I mean, I don't know, a lot changes in 10 years, so I don't know how many of them are still interested, although the early signs based on people who are contacting us is that a lot of people are still very interested.
Is there an age requirement or cap with the
there's a requirement that you have to be no older than 29 when you take the exam.
Hmm. But leaves you out, Heidi.
You have to be under 29 between the ages of, I believe it's 18 and 29 when you take the exam. There's no requirement as far as how old you have to be when you get hired. Usually these tests that they give, they hire off the list for up to 4 years. So, I mean, conceivably someone could be 33 years old and still get hired in the fire department. You know, that a lot of the guys who took this test even 10 years ago are not 33 yet. And then the guys who took the test 7 years ago, the second test that we sued about, are, you know, most of them are not 33 yet. So there's a lot of people who are still eligible age-wise. You know, I think a lot of guys have, you know, kept in very good shape because this is a physical job, you know.
Right.
And we'll be able to do it.
Now, Darius, the center will continue to stay involved, obviously, in the case.
Yes, of course.
What about an appeal? What do you think they're going to do?
That's a good question. I mean, they have 30 days. The decision came out on July 22nd, so I guess that means they have until, like, August 21st to file a notice of appeal. We have not heard one way or the other what they intend to do. We have actually a conference with the district judge tomorrow in this case, so I don't know if the city is going to discuss their intentions about an appeal or not.
Now, I don't know, Darius, if you're familiar with it, but at a confirmation hearing for Sonia Sotomayor for the Supreme Court, Mayor Bloomberg came ostensibly to say, oh, well, how proud we are to have a New Yorker from the Bronx be on the Supreme Court. But yes. In the course of that, apparently he talked about the firefighters case. Is that right?
Yes, he did. And that's actually the exact reason that Judge granted our motion to compel his deposition. He cited extensively to the mayor's testimony from that hearing and said, based on this testimony, it's clear that Mayor Bloomberg was personally involved in some of the decisions about the hiring practices of the fire department, and therefore, you know, he needs to sit for a deposition.
So great.
He got himself into trouble by
what did he say?
Going to those hearings.
What did he say briefly? Is there a couple of sentences that stand out?
Well, he basically drew a connection between you know, this case and the New Haven case and said that he disagreed with what Judge Sotomayor had done in the New Haven case and that he personally was going to continue to fight this Volkens case. He did not believe that their tests that they use in New York are discriminatory and that he believes the city is doing an excellent job of ensuring a diverse fire department through recruiting and other methods.
You know, I'm not running against him for mayor, but I can tell you what I would do in a city that's 54% black and Latino. Just take a guess. I mean, that this guy thinks he can. I mean, it's outrageous.
Confiscate his private jet.
Oh, my gosh.
It's stunning. I just am appalled at the fact that a paper test that is so old is being used when there are more practical aspects that will, I would think, tell you who's better equipped for the job.
You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, I think you hit on it, this old test. I mean, New York is really using methodologies that are, you know, out of date 30, 40 years ago. That's what they were doing 30, 40 years ago. I mean, New York, you'd think the biggest city in the country, you know, center of the world or whatever people say, would be much more, you know, up on the innovative ways of doing things in city government, and they clearly are not.
Just from looking at New York and living in it for so long, I mean, this is an entrenched system,
yeah.
You know, that is, I don't know what percentage are Irish-American, but it's high.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just an entrenched system in this city. And at one time, they held a lot of political power. And there's and every time I talk about this issue with anybody who knows people in the fire department or
yep.
is familiar with it, they are convinced that to put more blacks and Latinos on, they will not, and they don't use that way, but they say they won't be qualified and we will suffer. And they are adamant about this stuff. It's just an entrenched system that I'm glad to see that you and the center and Richard Levy, who is your co-counsel,
yes.
are bringing to an end.
Definitely.
Darius, we look forward to hearing what happens in the next few weeks. So perhaps you'll join us again.
Sure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Hey! We'll be right back.
We talk with Adele Stan, the Washington bureau chief of AlterNet, about her recent and brilliant article called Story on Town Hall Riots, Right-Wing Shock Troops Do Corporate America's Dirty Work. Adele talks about the connections between the pharmaceutical industry, the medical industry, right-wing media, certain congresspeople, Fox TV, Rupert Murdoch, and how they have quite consciously organized the human material for what eventually could be a fascist grouping in this country to go into these town hall meetings that are supposed to be discussing in a civil way healthcare reform and break them up. Adele Stan, the Washington bureau chief for AlterNet, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good to be here, Michael.
Adele, you wrote a very important article recently on AlterNet called Inside Story on Town Hall Riots, Right-Wing Shock Troops Do Corporate America's Dirty Work. And I wanted to talk to you about that in depth, if I could.
Surely.
Let's talk about why you call these people who have been organized to break up these town hall meetings discussing health care reform, why you call them shock troops, because that term has a particular historical resonance, and I take it you used it intentionally. I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, I do think that it's very important for us to look at the conflagration of interests involved in this whole thing. It's really quite extraordinary. You have the corporate healthcare interests, you have Wall Street, you have big media in the form of Rupert Murdoch, you have a Capitol Hill PR firm that serves all these interests, and then you have these folks on the ground, many of whom are actually espousing anti-corporate personal belief and don't even quite understand how they're being exploited.
Yeah, that's the irony, isn't it?
Because
the shock troops that we were referring to earlier were the mobs on the streets organized by the fascists in Germany when that economy was falling apart, and they were called shock troops. And you see kind of a resonance of that today in this country. But talk to us about those connections and what they're trying to accomplish.
Well, I mean, you know, there's been a lot of great reporting by others on, of course, Dick Armey's outfit. Dick Armey is the former House Majority Leader, former congressman from Texas, who works for a lobbying shop called DLA Piper, and he also runs a nonprofit called FreedomWorks. He chairs it. And FreedomWorks has been one of the major organizers of these town hall protests. And DLA Piper, Army's day job, represents a number of medical interests and oil interests and all sorts of corporate interests. What really caught my attention, and it was something I stumbled upon, was a site called ResistNet. And ResistNet is part of a sort of a network called grassfire.org. And Grassfire really organizes the far right. You have your militia types, you have your anti-taxers, you have a lot of conspiracy theorists who are talking about things like the Bilderberg conspiracy and, you know, all of these tropes that have been trotted out for eons. And they are being organized by this grassfire.org via this site that they have called ResistNet. Now, the thing about grassfire.org, and I tried to reach the people who run grassfire.org, is that they have some pretty solid connections to the institutional Republican Party.
Talk to us about that. That's what's so extraordinary.
Well, I mean, first of all, when you go to the site, there is an endorsement from Jim DeMint, who is a senator from South Carolina, who famously kind of announced to the world, well, at least on a conference call that was then, you know, leaked, that his intention was to use health care reform to, quote-unquote, break Obama, and that it would be his personal Waterloo. And here he is endorsing this website that is organizing these really far-right types. And also Representative Mike Pence from Indiana did the same. Now, that, okay, you know, that's just the face of it. But when you look into ResistNet, when I looked into ResistNet, I found that grassfire.org, the parent organization, is represented by a very high power Washington, D.C. Public relations firm that also represents a number of mainstream Republican figures, including William Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard, Peggy Noonan, who writes for the Wall Street Journal and is the former Bush speechwriter who promised a kinder, gentler nation, along with more right-wing interests such as the National Rifle Association and members of the religious right. And when I called them to just verify that they were representing grassfire.org, they never called me back. So I'm getting this sort of this thundering silence from those who, you know, are involved with this. They obviously don't want to talk to us about what they're up to.
Well, let's talk about what they're up to and what these town hall meetings to discuss health care reform have been about and how they've been disrupted by these people who've been organized through this internet connection.
What you have on all of these sites, and this also, of course, includes Glenn Beck of Fox News, who has something called the 9/12 Project that has been used up until this point as an organizing hub for this movement as well. What you have is you go to these sites and you see things like Stop Obamacare Now, and there'll be a listing of all the town hall meetings. You will also find comments, some threatening violence or wishing death on the president. You will find, you know, I found the logo of the Virginia militia on one of the comments. I found an extraordinary video by a right-wing reverend who uses all kinds of racist terms to refer to President Obama, calling him a Mac Daddy, which is slang for kind of super pimp, calling him a half-breed, all kinds of stuff like that. I also found the coup de grace was a very slickly produced video. I do not know the provenance of this video that casts Obama as Hitler and does things like dub Hitler's voice. It shows video of Obama speaking and dubs Hitler's voice underneath it. It compares, they have footage of African-American Obama followers juxtaposed with video of Hitler's adoring followers. It's graphically, they interpose the Nazi swastika with the Obama campaign logo, which is the stylized O. It's really quite extraordinary. The other thing that I thought was interesting is they claim a no-tolerance policy for disrespecting the president and, you know, for any threats of violence, but they obviously don't enforce it. I also realized that I thought it was interesting they called it a no-tolerance policy instead of the more common zero-tolerance policy. Well, I noticed that in the comments threads that Obama is referred to as Zero, which is a wordplay on the first letter of his last name.
Yeah. It's scary. It really is scary. It recalls a person that we interviewed who had written a book about a very brave attorney in Nazi Germany who got Hitler on the stand and cross-examined Hitler and was able to expose the connection between these violent street gangs that the Nazis had organized and Hitler. And that was something they kind of wanted to keep secret. Later on, that person was arrested and murdered when the Nazis took power in Germany. But they wanted to keep that connection secret. And that's the kind of connection they have here, that secret, you know, but for courageous, smart journalists like you, Adele, who are bringing this out. We really applaud your work here. Tell us some more about the various corporations and people that are interconnected in this kind of demagogic movement, because the kind of stuff they've been saying, it's not even true. I mean, the kind of lies they've been telling, it's not the greatest radical healthcare reform bill you'd want to see. I myself am for single payer, but the kind of things that they're saying about Obama's very watered-down healthcare program aren't even true.
No.
Talk to us about that kind of false consciousness that they have.
Sure. Well, listen, just if I may, just update a little bit about the other piece of the story, which is that a man with a gun strapped to his leg, quite legally by New Hampshire law, stood outside the rally with a group of compatriots, not the rally, the healthcare town hall that President Obama was about to conduct in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, he held a sign that said, "Time to water the tree of liberty," which is a reference to the famous Jefferson quote, which says the tree of liberty needs to be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. I noticed that there was a URL at the bottom of that sign. It said, "This message brought to you from RestoreTheRepublic.com." So I went to RestoreTheRepublic.com and found the website of a rather paranoid anti-government and sort of militia-connected, you know, loose organization of people. And I'm thinking, I'm wondering what the folks on ResistNet think about this. So I went to ResistNet, and sure enough, I did a search just on that URL, on the RestoreTheRepublic.org URL, and I found 29 pages of comments with that URL listed in them, which I think is pretty significant. So this is sort of this Restore the Republic is a, you know, rather off-the-shelf fringe operation. They don't get a ton of visitors. Nonetheless, ResistNet, which is connected to the institutional GOP through the PR firm Shirley Bannister, which also the principal of that firm produced the Willie Horton ad that really helped George Bush 1 get elected. It's a really clever way because it's very hard to really find the tentacles, you know, but they're there. And they're there through these really networking kinds of connections. There was indeed a link between that man with the gun outside the town hall rally yesterday in New Hampshire and this whole organized effort to intimidate people in these town hall meetings. In terms of the corporations, there's one very interesting and secretive firm involved in the Dick Armey-connected effort, and that's something called the Medicines Company, based in Parsippany, New Jersey. And they are so below the radar, they are not even listed on the website as a member of PhRMA, which is the big industry organization that represents pharmaceutical companies. But they do account for 15% of the lobbying income of Dick Armey's day job firm, DLA Piper.
Wow.
When I called them for comment, I got this just very generic statement that says, you know, any reports saying that they oppose any part of the health care bill are erroneous, but they wouldn't give me an interview with anybody to tell me what they did support in the health care bill. They didn't disavow what was going on in FreedomWorks. And you would think if they had a problem with what was going on in FreedomWorks, which is, you know, where they're organizing some far-right people to disrupt town hall meetings and giving out talking points on how to do it, I think that Dick Armey wouldn't be so ready to throw away 15% of his firm's lobbying income.
No kidding. This whole effort nationwide to disrupt these meetings to discuss health care reform is reminiscent of what happened when Bush 2 stole the election in year 2000, and all those Republican functionaries were sent down to Florida. The Brooks Brothers riot. But now they're doing it with their suit jackets off, no ties on their shirts. It's the photographs I've seen in the Times, for example, the interviews, seem like a lot of disgruntled white people. Some of them really misled, but all of them very angry. And there was talk about connections with Sarah Palin and her husband and the Constitutional Party and the lie that Sarah Palin put out on her website. If Obama's health care bill passes, there's going to be death panels. Did you read that?
Well, yes. When you look, Michael, at the narrative that is being deployed here, and it appears to be, you know, these folks try to make it specific to this particular piece of legislation. This is a narrative that has existed on the right for a very, very long time. And much of it is promulgated by a man named Howard Phillips, who runs the U.S. Constitution Party. That's his party, the Constitution Party.
Can I just give you a footnote to Howard Phillips?
Surely.
When I started out practicing law 40-some years ago, I was doing legal services work, and Howard Phillips was one of the people that tried to stop legal services firms that were funded by the government.
One of his major causes.
Major causes, because we were defending the rights of poor people. And someone went out to his house for dinner to interview him, he was a big family values man. And he was sitting there with his wife and his three kids, and he introduced this reporter to his three kids. And when he got to the third kid, he forgot the kid's name. This was the genuine Howard Phillips. He's like a bad penny. He keeps turning up. I know that you wrote about him. Talk to us about him and what he's trying to do.
You know, what Howard Phillips is one of the founders of the religious right. He founded that with Paul Weyrich, who went on, who also had founded the Heritage Foundation, and Richard Viguerie, who was the guy who appropriated the direct mail techniques of Morris Deese, of all folks, to put in the service of Ronald Reagan, getting Ronald Reagan elected. And these three guys really together had a very interesting strategy. I call it the inside-outside game. And that is that you had the two of them really working within the institutional Republican Party and one working outside of it to create pressure from the outside on the institutional party. The outside man is Howard Phillips. Now, what I will say about Phillips is I do believe he's a true believer in the things that he espouses. I don't think it's just, in his case, just, outright cynicism. I think he truly believes these terrifying ideas and the idea of a very vengeful God. Anyway, what Phillips has really done, I mean, if you go back to, I wrote about him during the election campaign. I mean, he was really the clearinghouse for so many of the themes that we hear from the right, the birther conspiracy, you know, the folks who say that Obama wasn't born in the U.S. Yeah. He really supported and promoted the work of Jerome Corsi, who was one of the prime movers of that idea. I went to an event where Cliff Kincaid, another right-wing operative, did a long quote-unquote expose of Obama's socialist ties. But apropos of the healthcare debate, though, if you go back into Phillips's work going back to, you know, the mid-90s, you find this theme about, you know, that's against all kinds of government medical programs, including Medicare, and that postulates that euthanasia will be institutionalized, which is what we hear from Sarah Palin and with her quote-unquote death panel accusation against the president.
Yeah, which old people and babies are going to be allowed to live?
Yes, that the government will be choosing, will be picking and choosing who will be allowed to live. And of course, this is a total falsehood, and they've, you know, seized upon a very wise portion of the bill that just allows people to have a consultation with their physician if they want to make a living will or talk about end-of-life issues. And Sarah Palin's husband was for 7 years a member of the Alaska affiliate of the Constitution Party, which is known as the Alaska Independence Party, which is actually a secessionist party. And Palin herself, just last year, delivered a video shout-out to the Alaska Independence Party state convention. So, you know, you have this long-time thread of all of sort of the paranoid narrative of the right that's been really percolating since the Goldwater campaign of 1964, and all these guys, Phillips and Viguerie and the late Paul Weyrich, came out of that campaign.
That's right.
It's really finding its full flower in the stories and fears and paranoia of these far right-wing groups.
The economic situation in this country has never been so unstable as it is now from that point. And I think that because of people's insecurities, they're susceptible to this kind of demagoguery and manipulation and lies.
And scapegoating of an African-American president.
Precisely. Yes. We've been speaking with Adele Stan, who's the Washington Bureau Chief of Alternet. Give us your final thoughts on this latest very worrisome development in our country.
Well, I really have something to say to progressives and to liberals, and that is that however crazy these folks are, I do fear that liberals and progressives have never done a very good job at seeking to assuage the fears of people who have really been dumped on by our economic system and the fears of really dispossessed white people. And I think that until progressives start looking at that, we're going to continue to confront these kinds of manipulations of fearful people. And it's very tempting to just, you know, be snide and poo-poo the ridiculousness of their paranoia. But the end result is we wind up with this. And I think we really need to start thinking about, you know, not just opposing these folks as enemies, as they truly are our opponents and they are very misled, but how do we create a counter-narrative that has some comfort in it?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Unless the left creates an alternative poll and an alternative vision, we're going to lose these people to the other side. The work that you did in exposing these connections is really very valuable. Adele Stan, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
It's been a delight. Thank you, Michael.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.